Ah, one of these days you put your trust in computers and what happens? Exactly. Moving on, welcome to the head of the School of English and Journalism, Professor Jason Whittaker. How are you,
sir? I'm very well, thank you. And it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's delighted to welcome you on board. It may be a completely different show from the one we'd originally planned out, but that's okay. We can go with that. We've got the return of Christy Bond. How are you, Christy?
Hi, Alex. I'm very good, thank you.
And the return of Eva McDonald. How are you, Eva?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. Okay, Jason, we turn to you first before we go to Nashville, because it looks as though Nashville could be challenging us in all sorts of ways. The good news is Cameron has at least sent the music across, so that is in the system.
Excellent.
So we won't be sort of bereft of any kind of Nashville connection, just we might not be live in Nashville. The reason being our telephone seems to have just ceased to operate.
So a little bit of chaos for the midweek drive.
Well, chaos is good.
It flourishes,
out of which emerges order, perhaps, or not. Your speciality, of course, when not looking after academics at the University of Lincoln,
yes,
in the School of English and Journalism, is William Blake.
It is indeed.
Published on William Blake, Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright in the Forest of the Night is probably one of the cliched ways in which people say, oh yes, William Blake. They don't think of his anarchy. They don't think of him possibly being, off his perceptive theories, a key person in the Enlightenment, a colleague of the likes of Shelley, etc., or indeed somebody who died in a pauper's grave.
Yes, there's been a lot of rethinking of Blake over recent years, but one of the things I always love is the amount of people who do have a special place for him as a poet and an artist.
And he is.
Some of it touches them.
Yeah, I think, a recent survey of 200 much-loved English people, he came something like 80th or something.
Yes.
Very, very much in there.
For somebody who was virtually unknown at the time of his death, he's come back to become one of the best figures from the Romantic period, or indeed any period of British art and poetry.
So maybe all those angels that he actually claimed to see
Absolutely. During
the course of his life, actually, fundamentally, they're there. He's with us now.
There was a phrase, I think it was by William Burroughs, who said that the best thing about Blake is so generous, he gives us all his angels. He allows us to see them as well.
Christy, you've just graduated from English. You're about to do a postgraduate master's in 21st century literature. So Blake possibly won't be coming into the oeuvre of that, unless he really emerges in all sorts of strange, bizarre, reincarnated ways. But your thoughts on William Blake? Have you
well,
encountered him?
Well, you say that Blake won't be, present in 21st century literature, but in a way he kind of is, because he as a poet has affected so many writers from then on. So it's kind of a ripple effect of his effect on literature, not just his own, but on the people that have read him and gone on to write their own.
Yeah. Certainly for American literature, he's probably one of the most influential writers ever to have lived. He gave a phrase once which was, I must create a system or be enslaved by another man's. And that's something that a lot of writers and artists have since taken up as their battle cry, as it were.
And often seen as potentially an anarchist, a New Age thinker, and
yes,
a whole range of
things
like that. We'll speak about William Blake as the programme proceeds. Eva, William Blake?
I've encountered him when studying sometimes. And he does, as Christy said, he does affect some poems today and has influenced some writings. So there is a touch of William Blake nowadays.
There we are, the DNA. It's almost like a private eye routine in the DNA, etc. But yes, William Blake was there. Okay, people are regularly expecting the Nashville connection to work at this stage. We're going to try once again. We haven't given up on Cameron. It may well be. We'll have all sorts of other changes to the programme. But this Wednesday, on the Live from Nashville segment on Siren 107.3 FM in Lincoln, England, Cameron's tune was brand new music from bluegrass favourites Chris Jones and the Night Drivers. I'll say that again, Chris Jones and the Night Drivers. Cameron actually worked with them a week ago at Sirius Studios in Nashville. They had their official CD release party at the Station Inn on Friday. So, with Runaway Tonight on Siren 107, actually from the album Runaway Tonight, with Chris Jones and the Night Drivers on Siren 107.3 FM, this is Laurie.
Glory,
I think, mind you, it might be called Laurie. Nothing to do, of course, with Laurie Hallett or indeed any of the other Lauries, including Laurie from the Partridge Family. Is it Cameron Tilbury?
No, not at all.
Exactly.
Although, if they could think it's about them, we can let them think that and it'll all be fine.
Exactly. As indeed is this phone link connection, can I formally introduce you to Professor Jason Whittaker, who's the head of school for the School of English and
Hello there.
Journalism. Exactly. And key William Blake scholar as well. We will be coming back to William Blake. It's Jason's first ever midweek drive, Cameron. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on the Nashville weather or the Nashville scene or anything else, because we've been just looking at the Chris Jones and the Night Drivers run away tonight, little number, and it's just blown us away in so many ways. Anyway, Cameron.
Yeah. They're a really hot band, and that's from their brand new album, Chris Jones and the Night Drivers, Runaway Tonight. They've won a bunch of International Bluegrass Music Association awards, and this album is just terrific. Got some special guests on it, too. If you know bluegrass at all, Del McCrory is on it. And it also had, doing some of the backup vocals, somebody we've had on, featured on the show before, Darren and Brooke Aldridge. They do background vocals on a couple of the tracks.
Fantastic.
So. Very
of course,
cool.
When people say bluegrass, I just think, brother, where are you? It's a Coen Brothers thing, really. I don't think, for me, anybody's quite gone down the line. Oh, brother, where art thou? Classic.
I think there's been a bit of a resurgence in bluegrass over the past few years. There's some really hot bands. We featured a few of them. Darren and Brooke Aldridge, New Blue, and these guys. I think there's a bit of a resurgence in it lately.
Well, let's cast it over to the team. Let's find out. Christy, what did you make of Laurie and the sound that we actually heard there?
Well, I'm not the biggest fan of country music, but I do always enjoy your selection and your choices, Cameron. So, yeah, I really like the song. I think it's something that you can play on, like, a hot summer afternoon while you're having a barbecue.
Thumbs up there. Cool. Eva MacDonald.
I like listening to a wide range of music, really, so it depends whatever mood I'm in.
Specifically, what did we make of Laurie?
I liked it.
I think you might go, first time I heard it, I have to be honest, Cameron, I thought, I don't know. But you know, I'm just being honest here. Sometimes maybe I'm just not converted to the bluegrass theme as yet, Jason.
Well, as a failed banjo player, I'm a big fan of bluegrass, actually. And that's not a complete lie. No, it was a real pleasure to hear that. Big thumbs up from me.
Excellent. Oh, well, there we are. You see, I knew it would work if we could just get the telephone cans to actually work. And I know it's the Atlantic where we have to stretch across there. It's phenomenal. Cameron, moving on. I think Christy's going to ask you those last two questions. If she can stop moving that microphone around there, honestly. Goodness, sorry. Go.
Have you had a completely wonderful, if not slightly brisk, telephonic link with us today, Cameron?
I certainly have. It's been short, but it's been good.
And will you be returning with us next week?
I'll be back next week.
There you go. Positivity. Notice the slight hesitation, because obviously phone lines, who knows what could happen.
Yeah.
Notes from a Very Small Island can only mean it's time for our top Jersey correspondent, Anna Maria Lewis, on the Midweek Drive.
Yay! Anna Lewis, what do you think about William Blake?
Do you know, that's a very strange question. I bought a book about William Blake only 2 days ago. His biography.
Excellent.
I think it's by Peter Ackroyd.
Peter Ackroyd, yeah.
Yeah, it's excellent.
Yes,
well,
he's
what
a very good writer.
Yeah,
well, there we are, you see, it just shows the way the whole show can slot together on that sort of basis. So Anna, I mean, we have the scholar par excellence of William Blake with Professor Jason Whittaker in the house, which is a Blakeism that I don't think he would actually use, but still, 21st century.
In the mansions of eternity or something
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. And I find that the whole, I mean, as I say, initially as a youth, probably it was the Tiger Tiger poem that initially sort of grabbed hold of me, but as one sort of begins to explore the range of stuff, Christy, in betwixt our country bluegrass slot, had a very perceptive question for you, Jason, which basically, Christy, would you like to just repeat it? It was, how I William Blake?
Yeah, why William Blake?
Such a long time ago, you know.
Yes. Seconds pass very long when somebody's talking about William Blake. Why William Blake? As I first really got into him when I was 19 years old and read a book called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which is all about the fact that the devils were right and the angels were wrong, and a light bulb went on in my head, and it's never gone off since, really.
Now, can I ask you a question? Have you ever read Emanuel Swedenborg?
Yes, I have read Swedenborg's works, yes, because he influenced Blake quite a lot, yes.
Well, I managed to pick up in a second-hand bookshop Gilbert Place? No, it's near Charing Cross Road. I managed to pick up the whole of a run of Arcana Celestia, Heaven and Hell, and something else. I had to make two trips to collect it because there are about 40 or 50 volumes.
Good luck with that.
But, but I find Blake amazing, actually. Yeah. I think he's very, very kind of forward-thinking.
Absolutely.
Sort of a man totally out of his period, if you know what I mean.
Yes, he's very much a man
amazing.
Out of time. Yes. And he's somebody who, he wasn't much known during his life, but it was after his death and in the 20th century that he really, really became inspirational for a lot of people. Yes.
I think the Jerusalem thing has really taken off as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
When you think how old Jerusalem, the song actually is, well, is and the lyrics and how they were relevant then as they are now.
The hymn.
The Dark Satanic Mills.
The hymn itself is 100 years old next year. It's the centenary.
Oh,
yes, yep. Hubert Parry wrote it in 1916 during the First World War.
Oh, right. What timing.
Yes, indeed.
Well, personally, Anna, I would give a full thumbs up to a little text called William Blake and the Myths of Britain, published by Macmillan. And in 1999, actually, that was published.
I've done one since then, yes. I didn't rest on my laurels after that one, but yes.
If memory serves, Anna, when we were both undergraduates at the University of London and so on, you were quite a William Blake fan then, weren't you?
I think I was, although I didn't do the unit. It sounds awful talking about your degree course in units, but I did.
They're modules
do that
now.
But I always liked Marvel and Dunn and all those chaps, and I think they, you know, they were quite unusual people. I'll tell you who we've had at work in. Well, we haven't had him in at work because he's been dead a lot too long. But we've had some inquiries about Thoreau, the philosopher.
Henry. Dear old Henry. Henry Thoreau.
Yes, who wrote Walden, is it Walden?
Yes.
He created a little sort of outcrop in America. Well, he has Jersey roots, you see. I think his father was a Jerseyman. And
Henry Thoreau and Henry Cavill, Napoleon Solo and Superman. What more can you ask for than to actually celebrate Jersey as the upcoming place? It's fantastic. And from your own perspective, Jason, again, the wealth of stuff that you actually did, and as you said, the fact that it's actually posthumously, like all, I mean, you could say in artistry, etc. Of course, William Blake was an artist and produced lots of other things.
He was.
He had clear views and aspects. I mean, certainly, he wasn't a fan of Newton.
No, he wasn't. A Lincolnshire lad.
Exactly. I mean, something personal, I suppose. He just didn't like the way that Newton sort of mechanised the whole thing, I felt.
Yes, although one of my favourite paintings ever is his painting of Newton, which is also the model for the statue outside the British Library. Yeah. And if you look at that one, the oddest things is that Newton, he opposes, it's not actually so much Newton's science, it's Newton's God that he doesn't like. So Newton kind of believed in a creator, a gigantic clockmaker who set the universe in motion, and Blake had no time for that. But when he paints Newton, he does him as this beautiful, classical...
Almost superhero,
yes,
exactly.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. He kind of... Newton's his villain and his enemy, but also it takes a lot to really become a worthwhile enemy. So he recognises that.
And some of his peers, of course, who actually thought, bless him, he's seeing these angels. But he did, right, from a young age, he kind of believed that he could actually see things.
But his seeing angels was purely imagination. Blake was under no illusions. He says in a letter to somebody once, you know, when your average man in the street in London looks up and sees the sun, they see something about the size of a sovereign, a disc of gold. And he says, I look up and I see a host of angels rising up into heaven. He saw the sun the same as everybody else. He just knew how to describe it in a way that was truly poetic.
We'll talk about obviously his influence with respect to obviously revolutionary periods at the time. Talk about the Enlightenment, the French Revolution, obviously with respect to our upcoming links with Los Angeles, California, and so on. Big impact there in so many ways with respect to, for somebody who effectively spent most of his life in England and so on.
Yes.
And that kind of impact and resonation within the States.
Well, he's one of the big influences on the Beats, the Beat poets and Beat culture. Mm. And through them on the whole counterculture of the 1960s. So when Aldous Huxley goes out and decides to drop acid, it's to Blake he turns to describe the experiences he sees.
And what brought me into William Blake, of course, the episode of Star Trek entitled Charlie X, where Mr. Spock is under mind control and quotes Tiger, Tiger, Burning yes. Bright in the forest of the night. Yes. You know, so never let it be said that we don't do pop culture references with the Midnight Drive. Christy, any thoughts?
I absolutely love how Jason just described him seeing the sun, because
yes.
I think a lot of writers see that kind of... They see what everyone else sees, but they see it in a different light, and I think that's a fantastic way to put
yeah.
it.
Another quote from Blake, a fool sees not the same tree that a wise man sees. His whole point was that you can look at absolutely anything and everything around you, and it's your perceptions that decide what it is.
In some ways, I would say that maybe a 20th century equivalent of Blake, in a different sort of context, of course, was Philip K. Dick.
Yes.
Because of the way in which he would sort of turn things around
yes.
and look at the perception.
And take the mundane and the everyday.
Yeah, work with that. Eva, lots of things to look forward to, obviously.
Well, I was thinking about the sun, as you were saying, with the sun as well. Writers they tend to be very metaphorical with things, and I really like the way that writers write, and they obviously elaborate on words. I think it's very artistic, the way they write, and it's nice to take your thoughts away with their writing.
Which is why reading English at the School of English and Journalism at the University of Lincoln is particularly valid. There we are. Shameless plug,
absolutely.
But there we are.
Thank you for that, Alex.
So I always like to do the corporate tick box, I guess. It's very important, Jason, every sense of the word. Anna, where do we find you this week? Because normally it's a case of where in Jersey is Anna Lewis now?
Well, I'm in the middle of something called the Liberty Wharf Shopping Centre, which used to be an old abattoir. I think I've been here before when you phoned, actually. It has a grim past, and one of our local witches actually did an exorcism of all the poor animal spirits that were slaughtered here. You know, not for pleasure, of course, but for food production. But they've actually turned it into a sort of Covent Garden-y sort of place. So it is a bit of, what's the word, an oasis in the middle of, like, a very busy set of traffic. You can probably hear the hum of in the background. Jersey's only dual carriageway.
Yes. It all adds, to provide a glimpse of colour into that island of millionaires somewhere off the French coast.
I wish. Not all, believe you me.
Before we head over to California for another audio missive from Annette Andre, Eva, would you like to put those last two questions to Anna Lewis, please?
Have you had an interesting telephonic link with us today?
I have, thank you very much.
And, were you going to say something else?
Yep. She's still there, just get close to the microphone, Eva, otherwise who knows what could happen.
And will we be hearing again from you soon?
I would love to, thank you. Thanks very much.
Looking through the photos you find in my drawer. Well, that's just me. Before we met.
Annette Andre, ace actress and top correspondent, now live on the Midweek Drive.
Yes, absolutely, Annette. Welcome to the Midweek Drive, where in England, at least, it's just coming up to 31 minutes past 5 o'clock, or 29 minutes to 6 o'clock. It's very confusing.
It's now, it's just coming up to 25 or whatever it is, past 9 o'clock in the morning.
There we are, you see, that's California time. So actually, you've got a great Wednesday to look forward to, Annette. That's the important thing. We can say that Wednesday is very good, so just enjoy it as you travel through the
time. It is, it is. and the sun is shining.
Well, doesn't it always in California, apart from when it rains and then it pours?
That's, of course.
Just a quick introduction first before we go into this month's audio missive. We have Professor Jason Whittaker with us.
Hello.
And we also have the legendary Eva MacDonald and Christy Bond with us. So there we are. So Eva, Christy and Jason all keenly awaiting the Annette André audio missive. Take it away.
Okay, today is The Worry Is, Will There Be Room for Joe Gould and His Teeth? In case you haven't heard, and I envy you if you haven't, America is once again awash with politicians polluting both the air and the airwaves. With 15 months to go before the national election to pick a new president, the newscasts are wall-to-wall with would-be candidates. The Republicans, numbingly the same as the conservatives but with sillier accents, have mounted 17 candidates, more than the populations of some small towns, and all reminding me of that old Etonian's favourite steamed pud, Spotted Dick, minus the currants, but just as insipidly bland. I become panicked when this season of madness descends and I flail about for something to blot out the horrible prospect of what's in store for me in the coming months. In quick succession, the New York Times and then the New Yorker magazine came to my rescue. The Times piece was about an Earth-like planet recently discovered that might well support life. The New Yorker article concerned an eccentric character who lived rough in New York's bohemian Greenwich Village and was as famous for a vast project he called The Oral History of Our Time as he was for constantly misplacing his false teeth. What, you may well ask, does one story have anything to do with the other? I'll get to that shortly. But first, let's deal with Joe Gould. The man, poet and fellow Harvard classmate E.E. Cummings immortalized, with the observation, "Little Joe Gould has lost his teeth and doesn't know where to find them." Cummings may not have cemented his reputation with that bit of doggerel, but it serves to show how well known Mr. Gould was to a certain segment of the public more than 75 years ago. When he arrived in Greenwich Village in the late 1920s, Joseph Ferdinand Gould was very small and wafer thin, with a rapidly vanishing hairline and restless eyes that seemed to miss nothing. By then, the long family history of mental problems was evident. The grandson and son of Harvard-trained doctors, Gould had barely managed to earn his degree due to bouts of depression and an emotional breakdown. But if his academic work suffered, his soaring ambition to be recognized as a brilliant historian and writer more than took up the slack. It was his destiny, he told all who would listen, to produce the world's longest book, thousands of pages, called The Oral History of Our Times. In dime store notebooks, he scrawled conversations overheard on subways, in the streets, in the flop houses he bunked in when he could beg the 25 cents a night tariff. He filled countless numbers of these blue-lined books and stored them away in friends' closets and attics, in basement lockers, and a trunkful in his family home. The intent, he said, was to give voice to the downtrodden, the faceless men and women who weren't represented in polite middle-class society. The history of the world was contained, he insisted, in the sum of the thousands of voices he was recording, much as Herodotus had done in his histories in ancient Greece. By 1941, a reporter for a New York tabloid said he saw a stack of Gould's notebooks that towered over 7 feet. Writers loved to write about him, the writer who could not stop writing. And the list of famous writers and poets he knew was extraordinary, from the prize-winning novelist and playwright William Saroyan to internationally renowned poets such as Ezra Pound and Marianne Moore. Disheveled, his clothes reeking of body odor, His beard often matted with the telltales of bygone meals. He became the bohemian darling of the literary world. Editors and publishers, one after another, begged him to let them have his work published. But each overture was rebuffed. Gould's excuses ranged from his fear that the publishers were only interested in keeping his history out of the public's hands, to a more concrete reason, that he'd forgotten where he stored the hundreds upon hundreds of notebooks over the years. And as his mental health deteriorated, so he physically began coming apart, falling down flights of stairs in drunken stupors, endlessly losing his teeth, breaking his glasses, and without them, left virtually blind. Even more pressure was put on Gould when the New Yorker's ace profile writer, Joseph Mitchell, wrote the first of two long pieces in 1943 called Professor Seagull, a reference to Gould's teen years, when he professed to have mastered the seagull's language and would often suddenly begin a loping run, flapping his arms and making loud seagull-like squawks. And all the while attempting liftoff, he was also expertly running the town's telephone system. Gould allowed Mitchell peeks into a half dozen of his notebooks, but then suddenly reneged on allowing him further access and refused to say why. Mitchell soon suspected that Gould's treasure trove of the oral history was a figment of his addled mind and that he produced over 25 years nothing more than those few examples he'd seen. Mitchell wrote a second profile called Joe Gould's Secret, in which he related his vain attempts to have Gould come up with the goods or lead him to others who would corroborate his having written more than a million words of the history. He concluded that Joe Gould was a fraud, a fascinating, if demented, con man. Gould refused to refute Mitchell's accusations. Soon after, Gould suffered a breakdown and was institutionalized, where he died. At his funeral, not a single writer, poet, editor, or publisher who had wooed him so ardently showed up, including Joseph Mitchell. If this tale, dark with Shakespearean overtones, ended there, it would serve as a caution to all who would impose reality on the fragility of those who live in another realm. But there is a mystifying third act to this unhappy drama, one with an unexpected cliffhanger. As if Joe Gould were reaching out with a hand from the grave, Mitchell began receiving letters and phone calls from men and women who said they had dozens of Gould's notebooks, and in some cases, trunkfuls held for years waiting for Gould to retrieve them. Mitchell never asked to see the notebooks, but this once prolific writer, a star among the elite of the New Yorker's legendary list of scribes, never published another story again. For almost 30 years, Mitchell would arrive at his office at 10 a.m. and leave at 5 p.m. His typewriter was silent, and so was he when asked why. And now to the newly discovered Earth-like planet. If the Boffins are correct, this almost mirror image of our home is everything that's needed to reproduce all forms of life as we know it. After reading about Joe Gould, I began ruminating on the long and convoluted path man has followed to reach where we are today. No one seems able to live comfortably with one another. For all our evolution, for all our incredible knowledge which has conquered diseases and put man into space, I found myself wondering if this new world would have a place for a Joe Gould, who didn't fit any mold here and suffered for it. Would a new world be more welcoming after seeing the mess we seem to have made of this one? Buried deep in Harvard's archives, only one chapter of Gould's history survives. It's called Why I Write and begins, "If one were to pick anyone up at random and study him intensely enough in all the ramifications of his life, we would get the whole story of man. I'd like to think that if a Joe Gould eventually came to inhabit that new planet and lost his teeth, some fellow traveller would find them and invite Joe out for a good dinner. There.
Splendid. Kepler-186f, we're on the way. I can sense that, from your own perspective, Jason, we're back to perception again, aren't we, really? I mean,
yes.
In a sense, the tragedy of an oral history of the contemporary world, all of those books, where you presumably you were familiar with Joe Gould.
Yes, well, yeah. I've read some of the articles I've been appearing in recent months about precisely this topic. It's absolutely fascinating. I hadn't heard of him before, this year.
And again, I'm just sort of
there was a movie made actually called Joe Gould's Secret from Mitchell's book that was made with Ian Holm, who had, I mean, it was the most wonderful performance. If you can get your hands
yes,
on it, do
that would
watch
be
it.
Very much worth seeing.
The writer who could not stop writing.
Yes.
And indeed, one of the quotes which I just thought was perfect from something we tend to lose sometimes in our hurly-burly world, the notion of imposing reality on those who live in another realm. Working in education, we try to do that all the time, of course, don't we, Jason? See the timetables, I don't know. No, go on, Annette.
It's just that towards the end there, as I was reading it, it suddenly occurred to me. It says, he called Why I Write and begins, if one were to pick anyone up at random and study him intensely enough in all the ramifications of his life, we would get the whole story of man. However, just something flew into my mind that if you actually picked Donald Trump to do that with, I think you'd come out with a different ending.
Well, it really depends whether he'd actually allow you to be in the room or whether he'd actually sort of send you off and say, go away now. You know, that's the important thing. Who knows what would happen with respect to Donald Trump? It's a bit like Alan Sugar suddenly becoming a surprise candidate to go head
Please,
to head.
Please don't tempt fate the way things are going at the moment.
who knows? Christy, thoughts on Joseph Gould?
I think I know I'm you know, indie publishing, and I think now because anybody potentially can publish, there is this massive pressure to publish if people know you're writing. And I think it does take away from the writing itself. I mean, I know a lot of people now are writing to publish rather than writing to write. And I think it is creating something that has something missing. You are getting a product with, you know, maybe not as much time taken over it. And something like what he did or did not or did do, that's pure writing to write. It wasn't written for anything other than to be what it was. And I think that's pretty amazing.
That's a very, very interesting thought you've got there. I hadn't thought of that. But yes, there is a pressure. People do want to publish. Oh, I must write this to publish this. I must do that to publish that. Instead of writing to write. And whether he ever did figure that he could publish it, and I'm sure it possibly was in his mind just for people to read. But as you say, his underlying element there seems to be to write. He wrote to write.
I think it was Robert Heinlein who also coined the phrase publish or perish, which summed up an awful lot of academia in America for a period of time, but I think it's come over to Britain as well in those days.
Yes.
Exactly.
Eva, really, yes.
Thoughts from yourself as somebody at the beginnings of her writing cycle in many ways, and more a sort of singing cycle.
Well, yes, I do like writing as well. So, but no, I think you do get the writing to write, as you say, and the writing to publish and publicise yourself. But I do think that it is better to write because you love it, because you get that. There's something about writing where there's a sense of having a passion for it.
Mm. Or indeed any creative art form, perhaps. Really.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, I'd like to say every month, Annette, you sort of pour everything into an audio missive from the joys of California. It's vital. Yourself and Arthur Weingarten, it's just genius stuff. We sense that. Jason, any questions you'd like to put to Annette, Andre, from her acting career?
Well, it was more an observation following on from that joy of writing, and also then the commitment to keep going when things go wrong. While you were speaking about Gould, I was reminded of the author Mervyn Peake, a writer and artist. So when he wrote the Gormenghast trilogy, he was serving as a war artist and one of the first to go into the concentration camps and witnessed unspeakable horrors in Central Europe. And he was writing this story which kind of summed up his existential angst and horror of what he's witnessed, and he lost his notebooks. So he had to start again all over when he returned to Britain following the war, But it was that kind of, it was that joy of writing to see him through the horrors as well that he'd witnessed.
Yes, exactly, and I'm sure pulled him through it. It's like someone who can paint or draw.
Yes.
They get through horrors by sitting and sketching and doing, keeping your mind into that. But also relating what was going on. It's very important.
Indeed.
Yes, very important.
Still to come on the programme, we'll be speaking to the Director of Marketing at the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, Nicolette Atkins, who will be joining us, as will Phil Lianis from Los Angeles and Richard Edwards from the city of Bath. But now, the last two questions need to be provided, and Christy, I think you can do this with your customary aplomb, style and mermaid-esque abilities.
Have you had a fantastically wonderful telephonic link with us today?
Actually, I have. Very interesting, and I loved the... questions in the comments from you all there. It was very interesting.
Well, we like to keep the standard going, Annette, even though you've moved from New York to California. It's very important that Lincoln is still there.
You mean the standard goes down when we cross to the other side?
Well, you never know. In case you're wondering, by the way, it's only 500 light years away. That's not California. It's Kepler 186F. We're sort of heading off there. It must be there. I mean, in fact, these radio signals probably will reach Kepler 186F in about, I think, 120 years from now. So welcome to the 23rd century. So.
I'll be around for sure.
Exactly.
We'll all be around doing this.
Well, it's to feel. It's not madness. It's a way of actually crafting the art of good broadcasting on Siren 107.3 FM. Over to you for the next question, Christy.
Will you be giving us the pleasure of your telephonic company again?
Oh, I hope so. I sincerely hope so.
There are some people who would actually say if you can actually manage to do 26 tasks a day, you're doing extraordinarily well. There are others who would actually say no, it's not good enough in all sorts of ways. And a recent survey that's part of Sanctuary Spa's hashtag Let Go campaign has demonstrated that when it comes to women in particular, it seems as though balancing everything at once, being interesting, being intelligent, having the perfect body and having the perfect home, it's all too much. To try and address these facts and address them in coherent and sensible ways and provide a whole range of other thoughts as well to ponder on, we're delighted to welcome that ace life strategist and superlative presenter. She is the ace and wonderful Jenny Trent Hughes. How are you, Jenny?
Well, I was fine until you said all of that, and now I'm stressed out.
Oh, no!
That's too much for me to live up to.
Oh, dear.
You see, well, it's really funny because you've just illustrated exactly what the situation is, because we have this whole list of things that we have to do. We have to be ace, we have to be superlative, we have to be perfect, we have to be all these impossible to achieve things. And so you're kind of like at a loss before you even start out. Except for that's not true. You just think it's that way.
Well, that's part and parcel of the whole package, isn't it? Because as a male, clearly for years now, I felt I can't multitask. And so you actually almost tell yourself you can't multitask. So you have to just focus on the hunter-gatherer routine. I thought that women actually had it all easy. It was all sorted through. But that's not the situation that's being painted by this survey, is it?
Well, actually, the whole question about men and multitasking is another one that I'll come back another day and discuss.
Okay.
It's kind of true. It's a brain thing.
Yeah.
But anyway.
I'll hold you to that, Jenny.
Absolutely. You know, the thing about it is that we don't have it. We don't have it all together. Mm. And the reason that we don't have it all together, well, there's a couple of things. One of it is a lot of absolutely unattainable standards. I myself used to be the queen of the to-do list. You know, I'd have like a to-do list with 80 things on it and be really angry at myself if by the end of the day I hadn't done them all. Mm. And then I came across a concept called critical six. And it's actually coming up with six things that you feel you have to achieve that day makes a whole huge difference in your life. And a lot of it also, you know, when I got together with the people from Sanctuary to find out what women were, you know, where their heads were at, what could we help them in any way make their lives better, etc., we found that a lot of it had to do with fixating on so much that you felt you had to do. And the fact of the matter is that a lot of it you actually don't have to do. And that's where the concept of let go came from as a campaign, because it's about letting go of unrealistic standards, unrealistic expectations, and things that you don't need to do.
Does the FOMO demon emerge every so often, fear of missing out? I remember thinking social media in one way can often add to the pressure of everybody else seems to be having a fantastic time because they're coordinating things so well.
Well, it's actually something slightly different in that, and especially as you move on through life and you have a partner, you have a career, you have children, you're not afraid of missing out. You're afraid of not being good enough. So it's actually what I call the cult of never good enough, where you feel that you're not doing your job as well as you should be doing it. You feel that you're not a good enough partner, good enough wife, good enough mother. And that's actually where the stress comes in. When you're, you know, sort of 19, 20, 21, you're afraid you're going to miss out on something. You're afraid that there's a better party somewhere else, a better rave, a better club you haven't visited. But as time goes on, you then start feeling you're just not good enough because you can't do everything that everyone else is doing, except for that they're not doing it. You just think they are.
The fictional character Jean Brodie, of course, was famous for la crème de la crème and ensuring that her charges and her girls would actually go on to be great, sort of wonderful individuals and so on. Is there a challenge with respect to education that maybe we're not celebrating girls as they're developing? That so, you know, we talk a great deal about getting through the glass ceiling and all sorts of things, but maybe this kind of British approach somehow it kind of penetrates to lead to folk feeling inadequate.
One of the things that I think that we really need to look at quite seriously, and, you know, I've lived here 23 years now and have been watching this, and I travel quite a bit. We need to readjust our view on working and accomplishing things. Because, you know, there's been lots of talk in the news recently about our productivity and how alarmingly low our productivity is. Yet we work longer hours, we seem to be, you know, doing more. Why is our productivity so low? And it's the same, a lot of this carries over into the whole cult of never good enough, is that we always feel we need to do more. We're not doing enough. We need to do more, we need to do more, and we need to do it better. And the fact is that in most instances, we need to do less. And we need to do it differently. And that's really what letting go is all about. I went through a stage, just to give you an idea. My mother-in-law is Irish. And my mother-in-law, God bless her, irons the socks and the underpants of all the men in the house. And after going to visit her, I thought, oh, that's what I need to do. That's what I need to do to be the perfect wife and mother. I need to iron everybody's socks and underpants. And so I came back and started doing that. And of course, that's absolutely insane. And nobody in my house wanted it done. They thought it was ridiculous. My husband was furious and tried to get me to stop it. But no, I felt that to be a good mother and wife, I needed to iron socks and underpants.
extraordinary. I mean, I know that ironing is said
to be... You're speechless.
Almost, yes. I mean, I know ironing is supposed to be therapeutic, but ironing socks, I think it's taking it too far, really, from that perspective, but still.
Well, it's absolutely ridiculous. And so, that's the thing, is that we need to do... I started doing something about a year and a half ago that has changed, elevated my mood beyond all possible expectations. When I get up in the morning, when you get up in the morning, you probably spend the first couple of minutes thinking, oh, I don't want to get up. I'm still tired. What do I have to do today? Oh. And then by the time your feet hit the floor, you're miserable and you just want to climb back in bed. When I wake up now, the first thing I do is I try to think of two things that I'm really grateful for in my life. Really grateful. And that, so it could be, okay, it's not going to rain today.
Being alive.
Thank you.
Being alive.
You sort of try to crank it down a bit. You know, this isn't a beauty pageant where you need to solve world hunger. It's just, I'm happy it's not raining. Thank you. And then, so you come out of bed in a good mood. And the last thing at night before I close my eyes is I think of what's the nicest thing that happened to me today. And it could be that, I went to get coffee and they spelt my name right on the cup. Yay! And so I go to sleep in a good headspace. And it's really the thing about stress and everybody being under all this pressure that we really do need to wrap our heads around is that it's not healthy. It's not good for us. And stress isn't something that only comes out of your mouth. I'm so stressed. I'm so busy. It actually then starts to affect you physically, affect your system, affect your emotional state. And that's really not healthy. And so that's the biggest reason that we really need to get our heads around this whole concept of letting go, being nice to ourselves, and being, the best, I know it sounds airy-fairy, but being the best you that you can be, that's all. You don't need to be Angelina Jolie. You don't need to be, you don't need to be anybody else other than you, but the best version of you. And you decide that.
Cultivating the attitude of gratitude is the phrase we used a few years ago. And it seems as though that is it. Can it be as simple as that, Jenny? I mean, is that ultimately what we're looking for to get back to basics?
One of the things that we do, I feel, is we overcomplicate everything. There used to be a phrase ages ago that my father actually used to say to me. I would be getting all bent out of shape about something, and he used to say, just kiss it. And I said, oh, what does that mean? And then he would say in a very dry voice, keep it simple, stupid. And it was true, in that things don't need to be complicated. And you find that the problem is that when you start fretting and worrying about, can I do this? How am I going to get this done? You then take energy away from yourself that you could be using to accomplish things in an effective way. You're wasting energy on worrying about, am I going to mess it up? And let's say, for example, you have kids. This can also relate to flatmates, dogs, whatever it is that you have in your life. But if you ask your children, what would you like to be different in your home? Do you know what they will say every single time? Just about? I'd like mommy to stop shouting so much. I'd like mom to be calmer. I can't stand that mum's always trying to run around in a circle. Mum always looks tired. Mum looks unhappy. Mum's short-tempered. All they want is a mother who laughs more. That's all. That's what because they feel guilty. When you're stressed out, whoever is around you feels guilty because they feel that they're causing it. So don't worry about ironing anybody's socks and underpants. Worry about hugging people, sitting down, having a chat with your partner, all of that kind of stuff. That's what's important.
Jenny, it's been an absolute delight sharing some calming thoughts with your good self. Quite clearly, that is why you are the best co-presenter Grumpy Old Women, Loose Women, or indeed This Morning could ever wish to have.
Don't do that to me again. That's too much pressure.
So then I take it you've had a reasonably calming and not too stressful telephonic link with us on the programme today.
It's been glorious. Thank you.
Jenny Trent Hughes, as ever, we salute you and we'll speak again soon, hopefully. Take care now.
Bye-bye.